I mean, what the United States and much of Europe needs today is an opposition which fights back politically, intellectually, with arguments, and when necessary, comes out on the streets, extra parliamentary actions to defend democracy.
We just have 30 seconds. The most important message following up on that rising up at the grassroots you feel people need to hear around the world now from your decades of activism.
I think we need activists more than ever before. I mean, one of the most amazing things has been this opposition by students in this country, occupations of universities in defense of the people, the Palestinians and the people of Gaza. We now need to extend these movements to what is happening domestically.
We're going to continue this conversation and post it online at democracynow.org. Tariq Ali, Pakistani-British historian, activist, filmmaker, editor of the New Left Review. Latest book, You Can't Please All, Memoirs 1980 to 2024. Happy birthday to Masaya Rhodes, Dante Terrieri, and Rustam. I'm Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez.
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Tune in to Locus Focus, a weekly conversation about our place on the planet, every Monday morning at 10 on KBOO Community Radio. Each week, host Barbara Bernstein talks with local, regional, and national experts, activists, and policymakers about climate change, river protection, the transition from fossil fuels to renewable energy, salmon restoration, forest management, and all the other things that are critical to protect our planet. That's every Monday at 10 a.m. on your community radio station, KBOO.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, snow is forecast for the Portland metro area tomorrow. For real this time.
Multnomah County will open 6 winter weather shelters this evening.
And in national news, the inspectors general fired by President Trump sue to get their jobs back.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 12, 2025. I'm Althea Billings.
And I'm Josh Salem. Snow is headed to the Portland metro area on Thursday morning. There have been a few near misses in recent weeks, but snow and freezing rain are truly expected. The rest of the evening tonight is expected to be cold and dry. That could last into part of Thursday morning, with the early part of the morning commute looking clear. But snow is expected mid-morning, likely 1 to 3 inches, before tapering off in the afternoon. Going into Thursday evening and Friday, freezing rain is in the forecast, which occurs when rain freezes into ice immediately after hitting the ground. That means poor conditions for traveling Friday morning, and drivers are recommended to stay off the roads. It's not clear just yet how much ice accumulation the metro area may see. Saturday is forecasted to be rainy, but temperatures are going to be in the low 40s, likely melting away any remaining ice.
One additional warming shelter will open tonight in Multnomah County after 5 were open last night. There is a cold weather advisory tonight for much of Oregon and southwest Washington. That includes the greater Portland metro area, the Cascade Foothills, the Willamette Valley, and the Oregon coast. Very cold temperatures, as low as 10 to 20 degrees, are forecast. With wind, it can feel even colder. The National Weather Service advises people who are going outside to dress warmly and make sure their skin is covered. Frostbite and hypothermia will happen if unprotected skin is exposed to these low temperatures. They also advise that people check on older family members, neighbors, and friends. Multnomah County will open 6 severe weather shelters tonight due to the freezing temperatures. They'll be open at 8 p.m. tonight until at least noon on Thursday, and maybe longer. 356 people came to the warming shelters that were open last night. 288 other people used the Salvation Army winter shelters or overflow beds because of the cold. That's 122 more locals who used these shelters than the previous night. The warming shelters that continue to be open tonight are Cook Plaza at 19421 Southeast Stark Street in Gresham, the Hollywood Shelter at 1815 Northeast 43rd Avenue in Portland, around the corner from the Hollywood Theater, and the Northwest 14th Avenue Shelter at 600 Northwest 14th Avenue in Portland.
Folks can also find shelter at Ascension Catholic Church at 743 Southeast 76th Avenue in Portland, and Grand Oak Shelter at 324 Southeast Grand in Portland. The new shelter open tonight is at Charles Jordan Community Center at 9009 North Foss Avenue in Portland. Each shelter is ADA accessible. Pets are welcome and transportation is available. TriMet will not turn people away who cannot pay the fare while shelters are open. People can also find out about getting transportation to shelters by calling 211. The county says that 211 coordinated transportation for 68 people last night was seen, and community volunteers helped bring 30 others to shelter. County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson said in a statement, quote, "These temperatures combined with wind chill factor can be life-threatening, which is why we're expanding shelter locations and capacity. No one seeking shelter will be turned away," end quote. Officials say if residents see someone who is not dressed for the conditions, they can call the county non-emergency line and request a welfare check at 503-823-3333. More information about Multnomah County's severe weather response is online at multco.us/cold.
The Trump administration has made moves to shutter the EPA's Environmental Justice Office, tasked with reducing harms for the most at-risk communities that feel the brunt of climate change and pollution. Advocates say communities will suffer because of it. Zimon Perez has the story.
The Trump administration has started dismantling the EPA's office that deals with reducing environmental harms to minority and low-income communities that have faced the brunt of climate change and pollution. More than 160 staffers with the EPA's Office of Environmental Justice and Civil Rights were put on paid administrative leave last week. More than 200 staffers work for the office, which was combined with two others in 2022. Adrian Hollis with the National Wildlife Federation says the EPA department is just like any other office dealing with environmental protection. A specific environmental effort, she says, needs a specific office to coordinate those efforts.
Some communities may file a complaint about the fact that given the contamination they're exposed to, there may be issues that violate the Civil Rights Act. Just as the air group, you need a focal point, a place to go, a place to get information and share information.
The office was first created by President George H.W. Bush in 1992. Since 2014, the Environmental Protection Agency has conducted more than 300 reviews of civil rights compliance, including 11 in Maryland. On his first day in office, President Donald Trump signed an executive order working to disband environmental justice offices across the federal government. The administration has also taken down a decades-old tool to track environmental burdens across the country. Hollis says some of the state's most vulnerable communities will be most negatively impacted by these major rollbacks and potential shutterings.
It's going to affect the ability of communities and advocates and activists to really focus on these specific environmental outcomes that are related to systemic racism, they're place-based, they're based on race, and they're exacerbated by climate change.
The administration has also paused all environmental litigations in the Justice Department. The administration has said it is following through on promises Trump made during the presidential campaign to whittle down the size of the federal government. I'm Simone Perez, Maryland News Connection.
8 IGs, or Inspectors General, fired by Donald Trump, are suing to get their jobs back. This new wrinkle adds to the intense legal scrutiny surrounding many of Trump's early decisions after taking office. The terminated officials say that Trump should not have been able to fire them without first notifying Congress, and that the White House ignored regulations that exist to protect individuals from political interference and retribution. The lawsuit says, quote, "The administration's actions have inflicted substantial damage on the critical oversight ethos of transparency, truth-telling without fear or favor, and respect for the rule of law," end quote. The lawsuit is the latest among more than four dozen put forward in federal court to challenge early executive actions by the Trump administration. Trump and his unelected advisor, Elon Musk, have cited a desire to root out corruption in government. They are working to dismantle a variety of government agencies, in addition to firing a number of federal personnel. Trump's dismissal of the 18 IGs happened in the first week of his second term, when they each received two-sentence emails titled White House Notification from the Office of Presidential Personnel. The reason they were given was, quote, changing priorities. The lawsuit says that is not sufficient reason under the law. Soon after, the IG's government email access was shut off, and they could not access their office buildings. Trump allegedly told Congress nothing about the dismissals, as he was required to do by law. He did apparently say to the press some IGs were not doing their job. Inspectors General work in a variety of positions across many government agencies. They are charged with finding and preventing waste, fraud, and abuse within federal departments. Their work is supposed to be nonpartisan, and the IGs themselves say they ultimately save taxpayers billions of dollars, protect vulnerable Americans' rights, and safeguard national security. They were fired from crucial departments, including Defense, Health and Human Services, and Veterans Affairs. Several of those who are suing had worked under Trump during his first term in the presidency.
Congress released its budget resolution this morning. The proposal extends Trump's 2017 tax cuts for the rich, which would add $4.5 trillion to the federal deficit. It increases the federal debt limit by $4 trillion. Also included are spending caps on what committees can appropriate, including a $100 billion cap for the Armed Services Committee and a $90 billion cap for Homeland Security. The plan proposes cuts totaling $2 trillion across most of the other federal agencies. That includes $230 billion in cuts for the Agriculture Committee and $330 billion for the Education and Workforce Committee. That means likely cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, and SNAP funding. Pennsylvania Congressman Brendan Boyle said the Republican proposal, quote, slashes critical programs that millions of hardworking Americans rely on, all while adding trillions of dollars to the deficit to bankroll massive giveaways for giant corporations and billionaires like Elon Musk, end quote. Meanwhile, the Senate is proposing a budget measure that does not include extending Trump's tax cuts or increasing the debt limit, putting those in a separate bill.
Inflation in the U.S. rose slightly in January, from 2.9% in December to 3.0%. That's 3% higher than a year ago, in January of 2024. Egg prices saw their biggest jump in nearly a decade last month, rising more than 15%. Overall, grocery prices rose 0.5% in January. Trump has called for the Federal Reserve to cut interest rates, one of its tools to curb inflation. Trump's tariffs, including a recently announced 25% tariff on imported steel and aluminum, are expected to raise prices and therefore inflation further. When Trump, who promised to reduce inflation, was asked by Fox News when families will be able to, quote, feel prices going down, he changed the subject and claimed other countries were taking advantage of the U.S.
A court weighs the right of New York City non-citizens to vote in local elections. Vice President Vance suggests courts can't overrule a president, and states increasingly challenge the validity of student IDs at the ballot box. With more on these stories, it's Catherine Carley with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We're emphasizing how important it is to emphasize your voice, and yet we continue to let a million New Yorkers remain silent in this process.
Wenyi Chin with the New York Immigrant Coalition says non-citizens in the Big Apple pay taxes and should be able to vote in local elections. The state's highest court is considering if a law granting that right violates the state's constitution. The law's supporters argue non-citizen adults make up a big chunk of some city council districts and deserve a say. Opponents say it dilutes the votes of citizens. Posting on social media, Vice President J.D. Vance says judges can't overrule executive branch orders. At least 10 judges have put temporary holds on orders by President Donald Trump aimed at drastically reducing the size and scope of the federal government. Congressional Republicans seem split. Senator Mike Rounds of South Dakota says you have to obey court decisions.
This president is saying, I believe I have the authority. You find out in a court of law. And if they are appropriate, and move forward with them.
Earlier this week, a judge found the administration in violation of a court order to unfreeze billions of dollars in federal grants. Many in his party are urging Trump to appeal. Speaker Mike Johnson says he believes the executive branch can make sweeping cuts to federal spending without the approval of Congress, despite the Constitution granting Congress the power of the purse. The Wisconsin Supreme Court has ruled the state's top elections administrator can stay in her job in spite of a years-long effort by state Republicans to remove her. Elections Commission Administrator Megan Wolf has been the target of debunked claims surrounding Trump's 2020 loss there. Commission Chair Ann Jacobs tells WKOW News it's time to move on.
The conspiracy theories that came out of that election were unfortunate. They damaged public confidence in elections in Wisconsin, and they were simply not fact-based.
Meanwhile, political mega donors, including Elon Musk, are already gearing up for an April election to decide if the Wisconsin Supreme Court remains under liberal control. The last state Supreme Court race was the most expensive judicial contest in history. State legislatures continue to crack down on the use of student IDs to register and vote. Republicans argue they increase the chance of voter fraud. But Salmia Sarin with Idaho-based group Babe Vote says prohibiting them intentionally discriminates against young voters.
Most people receive a student ID when they're enrolled in high school or college. Other forms of ID, like a driver's license, they have a couple more extra steps that can become a burden to some young people.
The Indiana Senate is the latest to pass a ban, which would undo a 20-year precedent. At least six states already prohibit the use of student IDs at polling locations. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Jeremiah Hayden from Street Roots regarding Portland's issuing a new land use compatibility statement for Zenith Energy. At 6, it's Sojourner Truth Radio. Then at 7, more radio, this time of the hard knock variety. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 26 degrees. Wind gusts may be as high as 28 miles per hour. Tomorrow's weather will be a wintry mix of rain, snow, and sleet in the morning and a high of 32. Today in history, in 2001, the near-Earth asteroid Rendezvous Shoemaker spacecraft touches down on 433 Eros, the first spacecraft to land on an asteroid. The quote of the day is from U.S. President Abraham Lincoln, who was born this day in 1809. Lincoln said, "The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present. The occasion is piled high with difficulty, and we must rise with the occasion. As our case is new, so we must think anew and act anew."
Native groups across the country are concerned about how President Trump's attempts to freeze federal funding will impact them. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native communities across the country continue to raise concerns about potential impacts from President Trump's executive orders and other administration actions. As the Mountain West News Bureau's Murphy Woodhouse reports, Native organizations from across the country are responding.
Of particular concern was a late January Office of Management and Budget memo that temporarily froze federal payments and sowed ongoing uncertainty across the country.
To see the federal funding freeze was very alarming and concerning for many folks within Indian country.
That's Matthew Campbell, Deputy Director of the Native American Rights Fund, speaking from Boulder, Colorado. His group was one of a number of Native organizations that recently sent a letter demanding the Trump administration make sure the U.S. government abides by its treaty obligations to tribal nations. The OMB memo was ultimately rescinded, but Campbell says concern remains. He noted that federal funding helps support law enforcement, education, and health care in Native communities. Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski herself sent a letter to OMB demanding it direct federal agencies to ensure federal funding to tribes is not affected by Trump's executive orders. I'm Murphy Woodhouse.
Native youth are urging tribal leaders to invest in young people. Youth leaders at the National Congress of American Indians winter legislative session say young people are addressing many of the challenges facing their communities today, including climate change, education, and language revitalization. NCAI Youth Commission co-presidents Madison Brown and Angelina Cerna delivered remarks to tribal leaders gathered in Washington, D.C. this week. Cerna says Indigenous knowledge, which includes young people, is a valuable tool for healing, governance, and a thriving future.
We must ensure that our leaders, our elders, our youth, and our spiritual guides are present in every room where decisions are being made about our future. It is about ensuring that our voices shape the conversation. It is about understanding that the solutions to many of the crises we face lie in the deep lived experiences of our peoples.
Brown asked tribal leaders to advance youth leadership programs to help them better understand policies and legislative processes at the tribal, state, and federal level.
The current state of Native youth is filled with hope and determination. We are not asking for permission to exist or simply to continue tribal youth programs. We are asserting our place in the world. Yes, we are youth, and there is responsibility in advancing our priorities, but we are youth with lived experiences and deeply rooted in the teachings of our elders.
A youth leadership summit is being held during the NCAI conference. Both wrap up on Thursday. Chronic wasting disease was detected for the first time on Northwest Montana's Flathead Reservation. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports tribal officials are now sampling deer herds to see how widespread the fatal disease is.
CWD is a fast-spreading disease that's 100% fatal to deer, elk, and moose. It's been detected throughout Montana, but until now hasn't been seen on Confederated Salish and Kootenai lands. The tribe say a mule deer taken by a tribal hunter tested positive. The deer was killed in the northeastern corner of the reservation. Rich Jansen is the head of the tribe's Natural Resources Department.
And our people don't want it on the reservation. That is a big thing for us because it's a culturally sensitive food source, frankly, that we utilize.
There hasn't been a documented case of humans becoming infected, but federal health officials advise against eating animals that test positive. Jensen says his staff will sample at least 150 animals to get a better understanding of how widespread the disease is. I'm Aaron Bolton.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The dangers of meatpacking work are not new, but the latest U.S. Department of Agriculture study puts into perspective just how unsafe working conditions in these facilities can be. It also shows what is needed to improve conditions for workers. Judith Ruiz Branch reports from Chicago.
Illinois is a top meatpacking state, and the latest study reinforces the dangers workers in this industry often face. 81% of poultry workers are at high risk for musculoskeletal disorders, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture study. Nearly half reported moderate to severe pain in the past year, but say they didn't report it to their supervisors. Investigative journalist Nina Ilkati with the publication Sentient says the high piece rate system, or how many pieces of meat a worker packages in a given amount of time, is the driving factor.
A lot of people working in meatpacking facilities are migrant and immigrant workers. Some potentially might not be documented. And so when you think about working conditions on a whole, there are a lot of different factors going into play.
About half of pork plant workers were also at high risk of injury, the study finds, from falls that result in severe injuries to amputations. Advocates for slaughterhouse workers are trying to improve conditions through policy changes and litigation. During the pandemic, the first Trump administration used federal legislation to declare meatpacking facilities essential, so these workers spent hours inside buildings that became hotspots for the COVID virus. Ilkati says since then, the combination of increasing the line speeds and a shortage of workers has contributed to unsafe working conditions.
That ended up being a really dangerous situation for a lot of workers. You know, over 200 died, many others tested positive. And that line speed, that piece rate that was set then has not changed since then.
Millions of animals are killed for food every day in meatpacking plants across the country. The USDA's recommendations for improving work conditions include increasing staffing to reduce the piece rates, adapting workstations to meet ergonomic standards, and improving on-site medical management. For Illinois News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch.
Supermarket coolers are heating the planet. The stores refrigerate food using systems that often leak powerful climate-warming gases called HFCs. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Keeping things cold has been warming up the climate. For decades, most refrigerators and air conditioners have used refrigerants known as HFCs, which are powerful global warming gases. And Morgan Vanzo of the North American Sustainable Refrigeration Council says a lot of HFC pollution comes from supermarkets.
Supermarkets are very large refrigeration systems, and because of all the complexity and the size of these systems, unfortunately, they're inherently leaky.
According to her group, refrigeration leaks in U.S. supermarkets create as much climate warming pollution each year as burning more than 30 million tons of coal. Stores can take some steps to reduce leaks, but Vanzo says the best solution is to adopt systems that run on alternative refrigerants that are better for the climate.
And the technology is there and ready to deploy. We just have to help the industry transition over.
The upfront cost of making the switch can be a burden, especially for small independent businesses and stores operating in lower-income communities. So her group advocates for funding programs that can help stores invest in keeping groceries cold without heating up the planet. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
A new $1.56 million grant will help indigenous tribes and nonprofits gear up to present a plan for reintroducing sea otters to larger areas of the California and Oregon coasts. Suzanne Potter reports.
The push to reintroduce southern sea otters to greater sections of the California and Oregon coast is getting a big boost from a $1.56 million grant from the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, part of the America the Beautiful Challenge program. Over the next 3 years, tribes and nonprofit partners will build public awareness of the need to expand sea otters' range. Robert Kenta serves on the Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians Tribal Council, which is part of the Alaka Alliance, focused on helping sea otters thrive.
Sea otters are an ultra-keystone species because they don't just maintain the habitat of the nearshore ecosystem. They create that kelp forest habitat, which leads to abundance and diversity. And that's always been recognized by our tribal stories.
The animals once ranged along the entire west coast up to central Oregon, but were decimated by the fur trade in the 18th and 19th centuries. Now they're mainly hemmed in by white sharks between Santa Barbara and San Francisco. Advocates are encouraging the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to launch a public scoping project in the next few years to support a resurgence of sea otters in Northern California and Oregon, possibly with donor animals from the northern sea otter populations in Washington and points north. Andrew Johnson is California representative and sea otter lead for Defenders of Wildlife. He says since sea otters eat shellfish, any reintroduction program will need to address the concerns of the shellfishing community.
We're already working on some meetings with the fishing community, trying to get to a point where we all understand that the impacts to them will probably be minimal, and maybe they don't need to oppose it just on principle.
When the southern sea otter was listed under the Endangered Species Act in 1977, there were only about 50 animals left in California, down from a high of about 150,000 animals. Now the Golden State population stands at about 3,000 animals. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
With Valentine's Day coming later this week, the more than 100,000 electric vehicles registered in Oregon are getting some love. Isabel Charlet has more on the story.
A coalition of clean car advocates has declared days leading up to Valentine's Day EV Love Story Week. This comes in the midst of the Trump administration's suspension of a $5 billion electric vehicle charging station program. But that hasn't put a damper on the experience of Peter Herkel, who has been driving EVs since 2011 and is the former president of the Oregon EV Association. He says although doing his part to address climate change is his main motivation, EVs are also simpler to care for.
You really don't have anywhere near the same maintenance costs to rotate your tires,
replace your windshield wipers and, I guess, refill your windshield wiper fluid.
Oregon hit a new milestone last year, registering more than 100,000 EVs, according to the Oregon Department of Transportation. The state is aiming for 90% of vehicles sold in the state to be electric by 2035. Herkel says being able to charge EVs either at home or on the road is the biggest hurdle to them becoming more mainstream. Even with President Trump's latest attempt to quell the transition towards EVs, Herkel adds, it's only a matter of time before they become the new norm.
There's no alternative. We've got to get off of fossil fuels. And for transportation, EVs are it.
Hydrogen is a possible competitor with EVs to replace gas-fueled cars, but Herkel says hydrogen engines take twice as much energy per mile to fuel and are much more complex to maintain. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael's favorite sport is politics.
The Super Bowl was a rout. Everyone expected a close game, but Philadelphia's defense stifled Kansas City's offense. The bigger game in Washington is a blowout so far. Our democracy has no defense. Trump has fired the referees, so there's no one to charge him with penalties against the Constitution. And Trump's offensiveness shows some strategery mixed in with all the bluster. But it's still early. The courts have yet to take the field, though we can't be sure they're all on our side. Senator Merkley is voting no on every Trump nominee and proposal. Even some Republican lawmakers are questioning Coach Trump's playbook. We have to do more than not panic, than jeer on the sidelines. We need to call out the media who's saying the game's already lost. We need to remind our teammates it's still early in the first quarter. And let's realize those in the MAGA hats have as much to lose as we do, in some ways more, if our democracy is defeated. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 12th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael, David Rosenberg, and Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Simone Perez, Suzanne Potter, Judith Ruiz Branch, Catherine Carley,